that is actually a draft written by Roland Herberg didn't change that. So the actors that are exchanging the metadata are still the relying parties and the OpenID Connect providers. What we lack in the OpenID Connect discovery and OpenID Connect dynamic client registration mechanisms is trust. And the chosen way to add trust to those communications are by a new compound, a new element that is added to the exchange of information between the relying parties and the OpenID Connect providers. And this component is a metadata statement that is signed by a federation operator. So in this way, you can convey not only the provider configuration information and as well as the client registration information, but also a trust by an external third party. I don't really know if I answered somehow the question, but this was just to give the picture.
Thanks. I think the answer was you got more answer than you asked for.
It's very interesting. So this information are very interesting, especially for the trust requirements.
Okay. Thanks, David. For your information, since it's becoming very technical at times, I have joined an audio recording to this meeting, so you can listen back later. But you'll be missing the introduction.
Not understand it again.
Good. We did have an interesting session in the ACAMP during the Internet to Technology Exchange on how we could potentially do it and what the scope would be of the ICTF OIDC Federation. In particular, we didn't want to overcomplicate the initial setup, so my really downscoping it to the RP and infrastructure use cases, I hope that most of the complexities that Davide would have to solve, we can bypass to some extent, just because we don't have all the openings in there. The other thing, that was something that Jim Besney was really strongly insisting on, we have to retain the dynamics in the system by leveraging all the trust we already have. So if there's a good way of, say, doing HTTPS-based retrieval and pings and trusting that underlying infrastructure, we should probably do that. Try to avoid all the discussions we had on attributes and attribute release, which several countries have severe difficulty with. I think in particular Germany has a tradition of having identity non-providers. They don't give you anything, not even a persistent ID. But apparently, as soon as people start setting up OpenID Connect providers, the core set of attributes is enabled by default and people would have to disable it. People never configure their software, so that's safe. And fortunately, the OIDC core attributes include your name, email address, and a unique persistent identifier. So I hope people will just keep that enabled. Discovery, let's not put it explicitly in scope, also because there is that OIDC discovery standard. So leave that to the RPs and leave it as it has to be done anyway. We just make our data and trust anchors available and allow overlapping federations and be complementary. So we use that community of interest mechanism so that nobody will feel that we own all the RPs behind it. If an organization also wants to join another federation, why not? And similarly, we didn't quite want to boil the ocean. The ocean will boil all by itself if we wait long enough. So we expect order 100 organizations and the ability to leverage our current operational mechanisms. But we do have a website and a trust anchor distribution and a way of communicating between the organizations and the RGTF as a central entity. So let's leverage that. And today, I hope we can make an inventory of some of the needs and requirements. One for, we might be online already, Michel Przeczka. I'll probably mispronounce his name at the moment. For Elixir and the Life Sciences AI. Then, once he has figured out the right time zone, Jim Besney will join from Illinois to talk about CI logon and Exceed. He miscalculated by 1 hour. Nicolas Jampotis, I don't think he has come back to us yet.
He's probably now on a plane.
Yeah, but is that a plane to Prague or a plane to Athens? That's I don't know. So I hope maybe somebody else will be able to talk about the EGI check-in use cases. But otherwise, we just have to dream something up. You're good at that. Then Davide Vaghetti, you'll talk about the ARC recommendations on OpenID Connect Federation and what's happening in JR something dash something. We already did part of that anyway. And then Marcus Hart. Marcus, you're online as well. Can we hear you? Maybe. Nope. You're entirely muted, I guess.
You can see him. He's moving, yeah, and he's waiting.
Okay, but he'll talk about what the token translation service that was designed initially under the Indigo Data Cloud project. And is now a core component also of the Life Sciences AI.
It's a piece of paper, what does it say?
I can't read a piece of paper,
right? Bigger.
Marcus, can you hold up the piece of paper again? I have fixed my mic. I'll fix my mic, yeah. Good.
Let's trust this.
Yeah, the typing works.
But does it work now?
Yeah, that's good.
Ah, good. Thank you.
Quick fix.
Yeah, and then I hope and I think Misha will have probably something to say about it, maybe David and others as well. We can discuss how we can actually deploy a couple of use cases with the tooling that's already there by Roland Hedberg, some Python scripts, some stuff we can write on the RGTF distribution side, scripting, etc. And I hope that also there are a couple of other people who want to join in running the tests, the use cases.
So can I ask, are we going to at any point discuss what documents need to be either modified or developed?
Yeah, we should do that today as well.
Yeah. Or confirmation that our existing ones just work fine, which I guess is probably not 100% true.
we should probably have an OIDC technology profile, for example. So that's certainly something to look at. Also at the way of how to join the relying parties to sanctify.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a sanctify slot tomorrow, I'm not quite sure. Maybe that's a discussion we should have to have that tomorrow.
Good. For those of you who are interested and not yet on the mailing list, join the mailing list, ictf.net/mailman/ORDCChat. And the link is also on the wiki. And if you are interested in even more OIDC, there's the refeds list, OIDCRE@lists.refed.org. And you can happily discuss at time or TNC or TechX, etc. So this is a very simple statement. Let's do it. But I think maybe we should first start with a couple of use cases and use case inventory. Michel, are you connected? Let's have a random. Licia, you are connected. You are the guest with the same number as the conference.
Yes, that's me, indeed. Sorry, I think I was. I don't know how I managed that.
Anonymous.
Yes, probably.
That means that Michel is not there. That's interesting. Jim Besney is still trying to get up and get breakfast. So much for my good agenda planning. Nicholas is gone or stuck in a plane. So that's actually.
So we conclude no use cases exist. Next.
No, there's no, use cases, they're just time constrained.
Yeah. Then I think there are a couple of us who are anyway interested. I hope. So could we shuffle the agenda around? Davide, would you be able and willing to kickstart the discussion with the recommendations from ARC?
Yes. I give you, so I have two hats actually in this. Oh, sorry, I'll enable the video. So I actually have two hats in this event. So one is from Giant as part of the Giant team that is working on the OpenID Connect Federation standard, and the other one is as part of the team in ARC in the GRE1 that is looking into ways to actually register OpenID Connect relying parties in a reliable and effective way. So for the effective part, for the efficiency of the relying party registration process, as I was saying before, in the OpenID Connect world, we already have so a standard to do the so-called dynamic client registration. So what is that? As I do have some slides here, and I don't know what it is. I was trying to tell the truth, but my video client is not working with this, unfortunately. So I'm actually connected via WebRTC. So I'm trying to install the new the video desktop client that is provided by CERN, and let me try one sec. Let me try to restart my.
Yeah. The other option is to upload the slides to the agenda to send them to me, or I can show them from here.
Okay, that's. I think I can also share them. Okay, this is it. I can send you my email, I think. Well, let me see. Right. Okay, sent. So it should arrive in a few sec. And so it's just a PDF. But anyway, I can start. So as many of you already knows, in the Open Interconnect standard, we do have three main actors. So we have a user who needs to access some kind of protected resource. We have a relying party that is often called the client in the Open Interconnect standard. That is the entity that will request and use an access token that is the mean to convey the authorization. And then we have the Open Interconnect provider that is the entity that issues the access token. I don't know if the slides already arrived. Yes? Okay, perfect. So if you can go to slide 3, here you can see an authorization code grant flow. So we have the user that wants to access a resource directly at an RP or through an RP. And then we have the relying party, the RP, that is redirecting the user to the OP. So in this step, the RP needs to know the Open Interconnect provider authorization endpoint, because the relying party will tell the user, or better, the user agent, to go to the OP authorization endpoint in order to get authenticated. Then we have all the other steps of the authorization code grant flow. And finally, we have the user giving consent to the OP to authorize that RP. At that point, the OP, the Open Interconnect provider, will redirect the user to the relying party's redirect URI. And once again, the OP needs to know and trust that redirect URI. And in that phase, the OP communicates a code to to the Reliant Party, but this is not important for our discussion. Then the user agent of the user received that code. The code is given by the user agent to the Reliant Party, and then the Reliant Party access the token endpoint of the OP to get to exchange the code for an access token. And in that phase, the Reliant Party once again needs to know something about the OP, the token endpoint. Finally, the RP receives the access token, and at some point, the RP may need to know some other information about the user that are called claims in OpenID Connect, and to know them, the RP needs to access the user info endpoint. Once again, something that the RP needs to know about the OP. So, as I was saying before, we have two standards in the, we can go to slide four. We have two standards in the OpenID Connect specifications to exchange information between the Reliant parties and the OpenID Connect provider. The first one is the OpenID Connect discovery that defines a mechanism for the RP to discover the OpenID Connect provider location and obtain the provider configuration. In the provider configuration, obviously, the client, the RP, can find all the endpoint locations. So the authorization endpoint, token endpoint, and user info endpoint. Then we do have another standard, that is the dynamic client registration. That defines a mechanism by which a client can dynamically register at an OpenID Connect provider. So registration means that the client will communicate the redirect URI, that is, if you want the client endpoint that the OP needs to know and trust. And also the client will receive, once the registration process is concluded, will receive a client ID and eventually a client secret. I say eventually because the client secret is used in the authorization code grant flow, but not in the implicit flow. So it depends by the kind of client registration request that is issued in this process. So if we go look at slide five, I think, a simple sequence diagram showing the flow of these two standards, we can see that in the OpenID Connect discovery, everything will start with the user providing an identifier to an RP. The RP then will use that identifier that can be, say, a username at some domain to determine the host to which the RP has to ask information about the OP, leveraging the WebFinger standard to find out the issuer. So once the RP knows about the OP, it can request the OpenID Connect configuration that is actually the OP metadata. And at that point, the OP will answer with the configuration response, communicating all the relevant endpoints, as I was saying before. Unfortunately, we do not have any trust information. So this is where OpenID Connect Federation standard is working to convey some trust, because we lack trust here. The only, if you want, the only trust mechanism that we have is TLS, and that is not enough, as everybody knows. So if we can go to slide 6, then we can have a look at the very simple flow for the OpenID Connect dynamic client registration as defined in the spec 1.0. So here, the RP already knows about the VOP because it has obtained all the relevant information through discovery or by static configuration. Anyway, the RP will issue a client registration request to the OP, and in the client registration request, the RP is identifying itself, communicating a redirect URI, or more than one, if it supports more than one authentication flow. And once again, the OP trusts all those information without a mean to verify them. So no trust information here. So the OP will issue a client ID and optionally a client secret. And then the OP will communicate those information, the client ID and the client secret, to the RP in the client registration response. Once again, nothing here is signed and no trust information are provided. So this is where the OpenID Connect Federation draft is working to add some information. In the abstract of the standard, you can read that, as we already know, we in the OpenID Connect we have specification by which the RP can discover metadata about an OpenID Connect provider and can register to that provider. Unfortunately, this cannot work in a federation context. We are on page 7, and this specification defines a way to convey trust, leveraging a trusted third party, that is the federation operator. And this is where the ACTOR standard has something in common with the way we build the sum of federation. So if we can go to slide 8. Yes. So the actual component that is added to the to those communications is a so-called metadata statement. So a metadata statement is a way to add trust to all those communications by signing, actually. And in the two required claims that are added to those communications, parameters that are added to those communications are the signing keys, obviously the public part of the entity signing keys, and the metadata statement itself, that is nothing but a JSON object with the name of the federation and as a value you have assigned JSON documents containing nested metadata statements that are rooted in that federation. So instead of giving here my own examples, since we are in the process of defining the way the metadata statements are produced and built by the federations, I suggest to directly have a look at the specification that can be found on openid.net, and particularly the OpenID Connect Federation standard as written by Roland. So if you can bear with me for just a few seconds, and if you can follow the link that is on page 7.
Yeah.
Thanks, David.
Yeah, it works better.
Perfect. So if you can go to the appendix, if you can go to appendix B example,
looking at SWAMIT.
Exactly. Perfect.
Do you see it?
I can't see it, but because unfortunately I'm on WebRTC, so I can't see the shared screen, but I trust you. So here we do have a concrete example. That is way better of any examples I I could produce. So here we have a federation that is SWAMIT that has a key pair for signing metadata statements. And we have an organization that is called Uninet that has applied to be member of two federations, two different federations. One is FIDE and the other one is VAMIT. And the story is that Uninet wants to register a service that is called Voodle, something that maybe you know very well. And it chooses, the Uninet chooses to apply for two federations. One is VAMIT and the other one is FIDE. Both VAMIT and FIDE, they have this set of key pair to sign metadata statements, and the format is the one defined by JOC, JSON Web Keys. And if we go to section B.1.3, you see that also Uninet as an organization has a pair of keys to sign metadata statements. So now if you go to section B.2.1, you see that Uninet build a signing request that is containing the actual metadata statement. So this is a metadata statement signing request. And what Uninet has to tell to the federation to which it will request to sign the metadata is the federation usage, and then what keys Uninet will use to sign its own metadata statement, its own information. So the result is now Uninet sends this information to FEIDE, and the result in B.2.1.1 is a signed metadata statement created by FEIDE for Uninet. And the same process is repeated for SVAMID. Uninet will send metadata statement signing request to SVAMID. And then we have the result. So if we skip to section B.3, we can see that the entity that Uninet wants to register is an RP, is Poodle, and Poodle itself has its own metadata statement, like in the SAML space, we do have metadata for service providers and identity providers. And Poodle needs a key pair to it's a key pair because it has to get its own public key to be signed by its superior organization, that in this case is Uninet. So now that Foodle has its own keys, it can have its own metadata statement in section B.4.1 signed by Uninet, both with SVAMID as federation operator, because Foodle as a relying party wants to be able to register at OP, Open ID Connect providers belonging to SVAMID, and as FEIDE, as federation operator, for the very same reason, because Foodle wants to speak with OPs belonging to FEIDE. So once FEIDE has all these metadata statements, once Foodle has all these metadata statements from the two federations, SVAMID and FEIDE, it can finally send a client registration request to an OP that belongs to SVAMID or FEIDE Federation. And if you look at section B.5, what you see is that you have this metadata statement, more than one, because Foodle belongs to more than one federation, SVAMID and FEIDE. And at the very end of this JSON, you can see the redirect URIs. So if you remember, in the client registration request, the only required information from the client is the redirect URIs. So the client has to tell the OP where is its own callback for both the authorization code grant flow and the implicit flow. So to this information, the redirect URIs, only the metadata statement's key value is added. In this case, it's an array because we have more than one federation to which the RP belongs. But so once the OP receives these client registration requests with the metadata statement, what it will do, and this is in section B.6, it's unpacking the client registration request and verifying that the metadata statement signed by that the signature on the metadata statements are valid, and in this way the OP can add some trust to the process and can trust that this client is part of those federations and that this client registration request was not tampered or modified from by someone in, say, with a man in the middle attack, unless obviously someone has access to the private keys of the RP. So this is just a part of the story, and a very technical one for which I excuse myself. But the other part of the story is that, and this is actually what is being discussed in the OpenID Connect Federation Task for Géant. The other part of the story is how to sign how we can create this chain of signing keys in an effective way and in a very responsive way. And currently what we are discussing is an online signing service where all the involved parties will need to send their signing keys, obviously the public part of their signing keys, to get them signed and then use them to do the both the discovery and the client registration dance.
And so who's going to check the validity of the entities applying and providing their signing keys? Federation.
Yeah.
How do we know that this is a valid Federation representative?
Yeah, so the one registering the keys and requesting the signing has to be authenticated.
It has to be authenticated.
Yes.
And it could be a Federation that is a federation that the other federations agree to federate with.
Yeah, although I think federations can overlap, but they do not necessarily have to all trust each other. You can have parallel federations, if I understood correctly.
Yes.
The communities of interest, like things.
Yes, exactly. The standard actually does not impose any federation model, so you can have many parallel federations and create very small federations if you need to, like if you need to trust just a bunch of RPs and you don't need to have a superior like at the end rank level. So it is very open, and we are currently defining the model by which we can create either a hierarchical federation model or a parallel federation model. I mean, the standard is not it's not obliging you to take one direction or the other one. Because at the end of the day, this is just a chain of signed keys. So you choose where is the root that you want to trust.
You look confused.
Oh, I get that. I guess you potentially. Who the authorized requesters are has an impact on, or should have a relationship to, the root of trust, saying these are the authorized signatories.
Yeah. What I could imagine, if you take a more concrete use case, is that, say, let's pick a random example. EGR would run a federation. And all the service providers within EGI register with EGI as an organization, maybe one level of interaction in between. And then EGI is a federation operator who trusts everyone below that. But they can integrate with another federation by, I think, a kind of multi-signing or cross-signing. Or they can just accept that, oh yeah, we all sign up at, say, an IGTF central hub, and we trust that ultimately. We allow our major RPs to cross-sign with the central IGTF signing key. Talking about it like that actually makes it look a lot like bridges.
Mm-hmm.
But then hopefully without the complications of path discovery.
Because you're doing explicit trust for the federation of the bridge operator, so...
Yeah, it's a mesh.
Yeah.
It's a mesh. It's a mesh.
Mm-hmm. So, if I can add something, another use case that you can consider is... something in the Open AD Connect Federation space that resemble the SAML federations, the SAML federation at the end-run level. So in the SAML federation at the end-run level, you have just one trust anchor, that is the signing key of the federation operator. Just one, no more than one, usually. And you have the metadata aggregate, or for those more advanced federations, MDQ, an MDQ service. But you have this metadata that are assigned just by the federation operator. So everything seems very simple, because you have the public path of the key by which every IDP and every SP can verify the metadata information. And they know, the IDPs and the SPs know that they belong to the same federation because they have this metadata aggregate coming from the metadata distribution service of the identity federation. And just one key, one signing key. In the OpenAD Connect Federation standard, something similar can be done with a federation operator key at the top, and then a number of organization keys just below that key. All these organization keys will be signed by the federation operator key, And then each organization will create some entity, some entities like OpenID Connect providers and relying parties. Each entity will have its own set of signing keys, but this time the entity's signing keys will be signed by the organization. So you can have a hierarchy here with the federation operator keys at the top, the organization keys just below that, and below the organization you will have the entities, the final entities, the OPs and the RPs keys. Once the OPs and the RPs will start exchanging information, like in the discovery and the client registration process, they will exchange signed metadata statements, and the outer signature will be done with the entity signing keys. Then you will have an inner signature with the organization signing keys, and finally the innermost signature will be done with the federation operator signing keys.
Yeah, but that would assume you get one entity in the world that rules them all.
Exactly. But this is for the. So in this model, you have OPs and RPs belonging to different organizations that want to speak to between themselves. But you don't need to follow the hierarchical model every time. So if you need to use a dynamic client registration process with some trust at the lower level, say inside one organization, you don't need to include the signed metadata statement from the federation operator, so from the root. Because inside one organization, the trust that you need to convey to the, say, to an RP that wants to register to the OP is just that both entities belong to the same organization. So you can stop yourself just one step below the federation. And in this way, you can create, in this way, the organization itself can create its own federation. And this process can scale down more, so the organization can have sub-organizations as well, and so on.
Okay. I have one more question, because it's probably as clarified. All the examples had lots of included metadata and signing keys. I think it's also possible to put it in by reference and have a slightly more dynamic way of keeping it compact and allowing it to change more often.
Yes, both the metadata statements and the signing keys can be added by reference, and so you don't need to actually include them in the communications. You have both a signing keys URI parameter and a metadata statement URIs parameter. So everything can be communicated by reference and not by actual content.
Okay. Good. Are there any questions to David?
Clear.
Good. Because we are in the happy company of a few more people who have joined. Michel is there, Jim Besney is there, Reimer is there. So it's getting nice, crowded and busy on the video. That's good. Locally here, Ian Wilson has joined, sitting quietly at the back, trying to... what I will do is, before we had a coffee already, so to ask at least one of you to give the use case overview. And actually, we're talking here, Jim and Michal. Do either of you have to leave really early? Michal, yes. So Michal, you go ahead and present the use cases or the requests from Elixir at the Life Sciences AAI. You?
So hi all. Yeah, I have to apologize for the delay. My name is Michal Procházka. I'm representing I'm actually the co-leader of the AI task within the Elixir, which is the research infrastructure for scientists from the life science community. And I'm also involved in the so-called life science AI, which is the infrastructure which should be which should help all the life science communities, research communities, to have one common AI. Actually, I do not have any slides because, as I wrote to David, my presentation will be very short. Because right now we are operating the AI for Elixir. We have a couple of OIDC clients here. We actually, right now, we do not have a big problem with the registration of OIDC clients because all of the services are relevant just for the Elixir community. But what we can see is that a lot of new services are most likely using the OIDC instead of SAML 2. And what we are expecting, we see that, for example, cloud service providers and some storage providers are trying to connect via the OIDC, and these services won't be used just by the Elixir, but I expect by other research communities. So having them register again and again to each other research infrastructure will be quite annoying. So that's why, and from our point of view, we would like to have some kind of registration of clients which are somehow trusted, or like in the SAML world, that there is some third party which tells us that this service provider is okay and it's verified and so on. So from our point of view, we would like to have something like the OIDC Federation, especially for registering new OIDC clients to make it much more easier, and even to maintain all the technical stuff of the OIDC, which can be presented in the Realink party metadata. And of course, we would like to have something like this before we switch to life science AI, because then we need to do some migration of the existing clients, and if there will be some kind of metadata which can be changed, that will be much, much easier. So that's probably all from my side. So if you have any questions, and I hope the other infrastructure will have the same problems as we.
Good. Thanks, Michal. You made a very interesting comment. Like, this has to be ready before the Life Sciences AI kicks off, which I think is February 1st or March 1st.
Yes.
Don't say which year.
Yeah, actually, well, that's we don't expect that we will be migrating all the OIDC clients next month. And actually, we have them in production that are in test, so we can still ask them to change all the URLs and hostname and so on. But for the future, it will be much nicer to have something like federation and dynamic metadata registration and so on.
Good. The obvious question for us would be, if we were to run a federation service, initially say as all of ICTF, which will do some kind of organizational vetting. You will know who the relying party is, but it will not go into, say, qualifying an organization as able to deal with human patient data. Would that level of organizational trust be enough for the large-size AAI?
To some extent, yes, because right now we don't have any kind of information about the relying parties. We need to verify that via other channels. So this will definitely help. And these kind of qualifying, if it can handle the patient's data, must be done even right now outside our infrastructure, because this is it cannot be handled even by some federation node. So then you need to have some kind of other, not the verification, but certifications and so on. So this is outside our scope.
We're writing it down as well. Good. Because we were initially thinking of qualifying the organizations as meeting Sanctify and the IGTF enrollment requirements. So stuff that would be common to many of our relying parties. So yes, there will be mechanism in place for compliance, but it will be centered around certify or sanctify and I think SCI. So that would in principle be good enough for you. That's already good, yeah?
I am struggling here. Can I ask a really dumb question? Now this is maybe it's been discussed already today and I've just missed it. It's been a lot of detail about it. The IGTF model in the past was that we were accrediting the identity providers, not the relying parties. So
that would change.
So can you give me a simple reason why this is? Why do you care about relying parties? I know you do for the Sanctify sort of...
This was there. The first time.
Is it exactly the same as the Sanctify?
It's almost. The reason we never did it, because the interaction with relying parties was always initiated by the user. So we gave credentials to the user, and the user was responsible for handing them in at the services. Here we'll be mediating a direct link between the OPs and the RPs. And the OPs will be sending data to the RPs and have to at least know they're sending it to the right RP that they think it is. So the RPs become active players in the Federation field.
Okay.
No, and they were not in
I understand.
The user held PKIX.
Apologies if everybody's understood this for years.
No, but it's probably good to clarify that.
I was getting more and more confused this time.
Maybe Jim wants to say something about that as well, but I think it's, no, you agree with it.
Yes, I think you explained it clearly.
I should write that down somewhere, because if you don't have it, then it's clear that it has to be written down somewhere.
To be honest, it is not 100% clear for me. But perhaps it is because I am trying to follow the video link, but I'm missing. I have the same confusion like Dave. I mean, up to now, IGTF was accrediting identity providers, basically. And now I cannot really play it in my head how it can scale to accrediting organizations that will be offering services, and how far can it go, and how it can actually interact with an environment where service providers might be sourced also from other areas. For example, I do see many service providers being available via the federations. Will they have to join also something different to be made available to the research communities? Perhaps I'm going too far ahead, but I'm trying to understand these relationships.
That's a good question. I think at some point you can make a mesh of federations. So if a research community has a trust federation, it can also start trusting other federations, be they national or other research or generic infrastructures, and you build a mashup. Also, I think a federation will not go down to the level of services, but will actually be registering organizations, and the organizations then register the RPs. I don't think we in the IGDF or any of the other federations would be up to registering dynamically emerging cloud services or containers, microservices, also say 10,000 requests a day. It's kind of hard to manage. But I do think the key thing is that they are, for the first time, taking an active role besides users and OPs. And I also think that that's probably more a problem for Davide than for us, that the complexity of accrediting OPs is more complex than RPs. And we'll only have a couple of well-managed OIDC provided identity sources, because they will typically be the bridges and the IDPSP proxies for large research communities. It's anyway better than the one OP that you currently have, which is only Google.
No, absolutely, absolutely. But the thing is that I think what David described, which actually had heard also a couple of weeks back, has really lots of potential, but I think that it is so flexible that probably we will have to figure out scalability issues, not only technical scalability issues, but also scalability issues of how we will manage such a potential. But anyway, I think this whole discussion is very, very interesting, at least for me.
Yeah. If I can add something, in the federations that are at least at the end-run level, process of registering a service provider is just slightly less complex than registering an IDP. And so I understand your point, because if you are using a bridge or an IDPSP proxy, you usually have to register just one SP you have to exchange trust between just one SP and a federation or a specific IDP. But what you have in this model is not just a way to convey trust between two different organizations, but also a way to manage trust inside an organization itself. So it is more, on one hand, it can be more complex, because inside an organization, and this is more true if the organization is small, and you usually do not need a very complex way to convey trust. But the benefits can be, I can see the benefits even for small organizations, because you have a standard way to exchange trust between all the parties, being inside or outside the organization itself.
Yeah. Good.
I have some very strong opinions about what constitutes trust. And oftentimes we talk about, two parties trusting one another, and we may only really be referring to something which is technical enforcement of some arrangement, and that may be well and so, but even if you look at most, even something which is very well defined as a public key infrastructure, and you look at a lot of the public key infrastructures that exist and have been used to convey trust between two parties, it's often not the technology that becomes the problem, right, or where they get compromised. It's typically the processes and procedures around the technology, or it's typically individuals interacting with the policy and procedures and those relationships that weren't taken into account. So if we are actually talking about having a mechanism of conveying trust, are we really talking about just maybe the technical implementation of that? Because if not, then we also need to talk about the policies and procedures that surround it. We also need to talk about the individuals and relationships and how we manage that with policies and procedures and technology when those relationships change, because they do. And we need to be able to cater that. So unless we came up with a schema that actually covers all three aspects, we may have the illusion of trust, but it may not get us to, or may not be what we actually think it is.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, in IGTF, yeah, we have specifics around all of this about the relationships, and this is relationship building that we're doing here with our face-to-face. It's the policies and procedures, that which is a standardized policy that everybody follows, and then we actually have technical verification that people are implementing what they said they did. And this is why we have established trust for more than dozens of years and maintained it, because we have basically ensured that we covered all three aspects, and we continue to do so. And now if we start to branch out and we're going to do something else, we want to make sure that we follow that same pattern of ensuring not just the technology, because this is a great way to implement the technology between federations, but there's still this aspect of when a new relationship comes in, how is that relationship validated? You know, how is it conveyed from one place to the other? What are the policies and procedures around provisioning, deprovisioning?
One of the reasons why I asked whether, say, a combination of the sanctified policy set plus the APs would be enough to satisfy the use case, or whether you would have to drill deeper into the operating practices of each community, because the first thing is something we are good at. The second thing is something we cannot do because it doesn't scale at a global level.
Mm-hmm.
So let's at least start with the former.
Yeah. And also, but I think change management is the other thing that we should look at, because many of this has no revocation capabilities.
Exactly.
But, and I think Jim will talk about that one, it is possible to do, especially if you use redirect URIs and, say, indirect URIs, very rapid cycling of keys.
Right, and so my other question that I didn't hear explained there was, you know, we talked about some keys and signing these things in metadata, but how long lived are these keys? Are they just meant to be trusted forevermore? And then, as you just said, what if we need to revoke one for some reason? How is that managed?
Yeah, this is very important, and I cannot agree more with what you have said just a few seconds ago. So that this is just the technical part. So another thing is the process is, I mean, the process of managing trust is all another business. And but as for how long this the signature is to be valid, and if we need or not a revocation process, I can tell you that we had a brief meeting, a 2 days meeting in the beginning of this month in Amsterdam for the Open Ed Connect Federation task. And so our first opinion about a revocation process is that we are trying to avoid it, to avoid a revocation process. And what we are up to is actually limiting the lifetime of the signature validity, the more the better, and having, as I was saying, a metadata statement signing online signing service So all the signatures will be renewed in the order of the minutes. So the validity of those metadata statements and of the registration, of the client registration, will be should be in the order of 10 to 15 minutes. This is what we are actually envisioning.
Right, so now you've got to balance, you're going to balance, and this always happens when you try to avoid revocation.
Exactly.
You can avoid the overhead of having to check the revocation by making it short-lived signatures, but if you do short-lived signatures, you're on the flip side committing to high availability in terms of the service that's providing the signing. So any federation basically would need to have such capabilities and be willing to make some commitment about those capabilities before being able to effectively federate with one another.
Exactly, exactly. So we are currently trying to find out the balance between these different requirements.
I think when we discussed this one in TechX a couple of months back, technically, the idea was that when we were not at 15 minutes, I think we were at a day at that time to recycle it every day, but to actually trust a callback. So an organization that needs a metadata signed could ping the federation operator, go grab my metadata from a URL that you already know and trust, say over HTTPS, sign it and give it back to me. And by doing that, say, pinged on the outside, you would be able to distribute signing. All of the machines you could ping actually have a signing key, say an HSM or so, sign it and send it back. And that will give you some redundancy and the ability for the organizations to request signing whenever they want it. And actually, that ping is not doesn't need to be authenticated. Given the URL at which the metadata is that will need to be signed, that's the trusted operation. Signing it again is free, apart from trying to DDoS the service.
Yes, obviously you will have to authenticate the signing service itself, and this is not a matter.
And not necessarily. If you pre-register the place where the metadata will be retrieved from. So you don't send metadata for signing, but you ask a pre-registered URL that points to the metadata to have that one re-signed.
Oh, yes, yes.
Authenticate.
Unless they change. Yes, yes, you're right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Then the metadata can change, but the URL referring to the metadata is the only trusted element you need.
Yes, yes.
And then you can do away with the request for authenticating the signing request.
But in that case, you're trusting HTTPS. Is that correct? You're yeah, assuming that you're getting the valid metadata, which I'm yeah, fine with, but I understand some of the developers of OIDC Federation want a solution that doesn't rely on solely trusting HTTPS.
Why do I feel like I'm having the same conversation that we have done for many years, not the one that you've just pointed out, Jim? I'm talking to the context of how long the signatures should be good for. It's the classic PKI debate of should I do OCSP or should I do CRL? Should I have something that can provide me instantaneous status about something that I ask, or do I want to put an infrastructure in place that says go check something that's going to be signed less frequently and maybe a little bit different format? We're really talking about the same thing. And traditionally, OCSP creates much more of an overhead, if we want to create an analogy, than CRLs do. So if we're willing to live with more of a 24 hours, that might be more reasonable for a lot of operators. Because yeah, you could sign something, publish it. every 24 hours, that could be scripted, and somebody could go to a well-known URL, pull it, done. As opposed to having something available that says, is it valid now? Or is it valid 15 minutes? Sign. That's a lot more over here.
Yeah. It also increases the number of round trips you have to do before you actually get in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of the push is to getting fewer round trips because of just latency.
Mm-hmm.
In getting to the resource, if you have to, even adding TLS on top of TCP already adds one round trip, at least. So if you're on a long latency link, you probably want slightly longer lived stuff.
Yes, but please consider that the client registration request can happen in the background, and it has not to be linked to the user trying, I mean, a user trying to access a resource. So this is traditionally the way the client registration request works in the OpenID Connect spec, but just for the first time, when the client registers itself for the first time to the OP. But then all the subsequent client registration requests, given that a client registration lasts for 15 minutes, can happen in the background.
Yeah.
But all your considerations are very important.
Yeah. If you have very short-lived federation statements, but you do the client registration and you leave that one active for a week, what does that short federation lifetime actually bring you?
Mm-hmm. Overhead.
Oh, yes.
You would probably have to cycle client registrations at least the same frequency, if not more, or more frequent than the federation signing keys.
Oh, yes. That is the upper bound limit.
I can see I need more bandwidth. Good. Are there any more questions to Michel at this moment, or the Elixir or the Life Science AI, before you have to leave? No? Then I'd actually propose we do have coffee. Jim, can you stay online for a few more for hours?
Yes.
Or so?
I can stay for 2 more hours.
2 more hours. Oh, that's good. So we can actually have a decent coffee, including all the goodies that we have here and that we cannot share over video.
Oh, look, we'll take a picture of them. You can see.
And I'll upload all your slides to the agenda page if I've already done so. So see our logon is there, and also Nicolas will be able to join. I think 15 minutes or so.
Perfect.
Good. We'll have a coffee break now for, say, about 15, 20 minutes. But you're free to have coffee as well, especially if it's very early in the morning. Good.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Yeah, for some time, and sort of, and then realizing that somebody walked off with his laptop. But then they also realized that there was a machine standing there which was not his. So they worked out what had happened. But again,
good. I think we're slightly over time. Maybe not too much. So let's get started again with Jim, and then we move on to Nicolas if he has joined, and then Marcus. I think Nicolas, I hope you feel good being back in Athens again.
Oh, he's now back in Athens.
Better than being started in Munich, yes.
You went skiing for the day to Munich, though.
Nothing like that.
Good. Jim, please go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Hi, everyone, and sorry I can't be there in person. And sorry I missed some of the presentations earlier today. I'll try and go quick through my material so we have lots of good time for discussion. So in addition to talking about CLogon, I'm going to mention our new PsyTokens project a couple times, and I'll describe what that's all about in a few slides. So right now, one of our big motivations for looking at policy around OIDC Federation is XSEED. And is Derek there in the room?
No, he's not.
Okay. So I'll try to represent XSEED accurately without Derek to correct me, but of course, Derek and Jim Marstel are good XSEED representatives to IGTF also. But XSEED has for over 6 months now been planning for a Globus migration from X509 to the OIDC-based Globus Auth, in part because of the end of support by Globus of the Globus Toolkit, although many of you know about the community support that's spinning up around the open source Globus Toolkit. And so that's not totally going away in our community, but we do see the trends to move from X509 to OIDC. And so there's a link there to the XSEED activity around that. And then so specifically, XSEED is looking at how to maintain our credential assurance policies for XSEED users and systems as we move to OIDC, ideally benefiting from the IGTF trust community, the scalable procedures that IGTF follows, and the good policies that we already have in place. And so for this reason, I think XSEED is very interested in IGTF work in OIDC Federation, and I think it's a good motivation for us. A few topics on my mind around OIDC and OAuth Federation. We look to federations to tell us about control of namespaces for the issuance and the issuer identity and the subscriber identity. And so in vanilla OIDC, that's primarily DNS-based because you publish your metadata at a well-known HTTPS URL. But we know from the SAML world that you can also have a registrar-based process for controlling namespace, and also in IGTF, we manage the namespaces through our processes. So I think that's namespace ownership is an important consideration for how we might do OIDC Federation. Key exchange is another important value that we get from Federation. Just basic OIDC, we're trusting HTTPS for getting the metadata that includes the keys, and that's very nice and dynamic. And as we already talked a little bit, that allows us to rotate our keys fairly frequently, and everybody can pull the updated keys over HTTPS compared to signed metadata like we have in the SAML world and we have in the OIDC Federation spec. So I think I'm thinking back to the discussions about whether IGTF should do a bridge PKI and sign keys directly compared to our PGP signed tarball. And so I'm wondering how that analogy of the option we chose in the X509 space can relate to what we plan to do in the OIDC space. But as Scott and others have pointed out, trust is a lot about policy. And so certify, sanctify are very important there. I think the work of the ReFed's assurance working group to translate from levels of assurance like IGTF Birch into the SAML world and also hopefully translating that to the OIDC world, I think can be very valuable. And then I'm interested not just in our authentication assurance profiles, but also our attribute authority assurance profiles for other types of assertions that we're going to be issuing in the OAuth space, and Psi tokens is the example there. So CI logon, I think probably everybody's familiar with. It supports federated identity and access management using OpenID Connect, issuing ID tokens that have the basic claims, issuer, subject ID, name, and email, and then we add some additional claims that are related to our research projects and from the IDPs, like membership and EPPN. We pass that along from the identity provider, and affiliation, like whether you're a staff or student at the home identity provider. Psi tokens, by contrast, is focused exclusively on federated authorization, and so that's OAuth 2.0 access tokens. They still have an issuer and a subject ID, but the scope is the key claim in the access token there, because it's a capability token that says what resources you're able to access. And the Psi tokens project just started about 6 months ago, and we've decided to look very heavily on the on work on OAuth token exchange, which supports delegation of these tokens. And as we all know from the grid world, delegation is a very important use case. And so that gives an acting on behalf of ability in OAuth, and then you can further refine the scopes in an SCP claim. So here's an example cleaned up a bit for a CI logon ID token, with an issue time, an expiration time, the issuer, and the subject ID. OIDC is very explicit that your unique ID is always the combination of the issuer and the subject. And so I know we've had some challenges in the past with in the X509 world looking just at the subject DN without looking at the issuer DN as well. At least in OIDC, that's explicit. The subject of that ID is always considered to be under the issuer namespace. And the other claims, audience claim about what client is receiving this ID token, and then the other, the identity attributes, name, membership, et cetera. On the Psi token side, we've got an issuer here. We're showing that because this is an access token for specific resources, we're issuing a token that's specific to the CMS experiment, and it's giving read access to some CMS data and write access to the user's output directory. And so the audience there is specific to CMS. And so I think you've already heard a lot about OIDC metadata. It's got lots of good things in it, including the key location, the JWKS URI that gives us a way of looking up the keys for verifying signatures. There's also some nice optional policy URIs in there, the OP policy URI that we might be able to use. And so here's a snip of CI logon metadata. We've got the issuer, where our keys are located, and our OIDC endpoints. And so if you follow the JSON web key URI, you can see we've got multiple keys of different sizes. And so this is where we can publish new keys as we're rotating out the keys. And so it's up to us to keep track of how long lived our tokens are, that and the longest lived tokens are the refresh tokens. And so as refresh tokens are exchanged, we can rotate out old keys that are no longer in use. And then the example Psi tokens metadata for CMS is we still have the issuer and the key URI and then just a single token endpoint because we're just doing the token exchange in that case. So an important thing to see here is that the metadata is always published at a well-known location that is relative to the issuer. And so if we know the issuer, we can find the metadata associated with it. So how does this match up with what we've done in the X509 world at IGTF for many years? So here's just an example of the CA metadata for CI Longhand Basic. And it's got a URL for our homepage. It's got the location of the public key, some contact information, some policy information that it's an IOTA CA, and some namespace information. So if we were to follow that implementation and just translate it into OIDC space, well, we need the OIDC issuer URL, and that's what gives us the location of the metadata and the controlled namespace for that OIDC provider. We don't have CRLs. We talked a bit about that. But things like policy, whether you're accredited under a certain policy is still very important. Having contact information, because the OpenID provider is not accessible, for example, and you need to reach somebody. Getting that from an IGTF OIDC distribution could be very helpful for establishing trust in the OpenID providers. So having metadata like this could help exceed figure out which OpenID providers meet exceed policy requirements. Yeah, so that's it. So I neglected to say anything about client registration, but I just forgot. It's a really important topic. And so let me just add that from a policy perspective, for CI logon, the most important thing for us is that the client or the relying party is in the research community, that we're able to use the RNS attributes, the research and scholarship attributes from the campuses with this research application, and that it's not a commercial application. And so we have rejected client registrations to CI logon because they've been from commercial entities. And so some way of scaling that up so that we don't need to manually verify and validate each client registration. And also on the client side, they don't have to go through a registration process with many OPs. That could be a real value from OIDC Federation. So I'm interested in learning more about dynamic client registration in the Federation context. Currently, CI logon has only static client registration, but especially for CI logon scaling up and for Psi tokens, dynamic client registration will be very important for us in the future. So that's all for me. Let's discuss.
Good. Thanks. Are there any immediate questions or confusion?
No.
No, there's some clear good use cases there. Yeah.
I think we should certainly cater them. I can come up with some of the ideas about what it would work. Having listened to the talk by Roland earlier and the, say, community of interest thing, mapping what's currently entity categories onto those community of interest would actually be a kind of natural mapping, and that would expose itself essentially not having the IGTF as a federation, but the IGTF managing a whole bunch of federations. Just like we do with IOTA, SLICS, and MIX today. You would have IGTF RNS, IGTF COCO, IGTF heavily commercial and overpriced. I don't know whether anyone would want to be in that category.
That's IGTF vodka.
Vodka?
Vodka.
If I shout something like this to the other people who are doing OIDC Federation, have you considered doing OIDC, say, different federations for what are currently metadata tags? David, has that come up anywhere else?
Sorry, David, could you, I didn't understand clearly, so you were referring to metadata tags?
Yeah, just like we have in SAML space, say RNS or dpcover.
Yeah, entity categories, yes. Yes, we thought about that a little bit, and we currently have basically two models to implement them, something like the entity categories. And one of them is defining entity categories as another federation. And that is in a hierarchical model where you have the federation operator at the top, or a federation of federations as well, with a root signing key, and say you have Edugain, and as the uppermost federation, and then a bunch of federation keys that are signed by the Edugain key as well. So a model to implement entity categories could be that just below Edugain you don't have national federations or research community federation as well, like IGTF, but a set of intermediate federations that are the entity categories. So you can have Edugain, then Edugain Research and Scholarship, and below Edugain Research and Scholarship, you will have IGTF, In Common, SVAMID, EDEN, and the likes. And the interesting thing about this model is that you can still belong directly to Edugain as well. So this is, it's a very convenient way to implement the entity categories as, if you want, sub-communities or clubs, if you want. And it's convenient because if you did implement all the OpenID Connect Federation specification, you already have the mechanism to flatten the metadata, the nested metadata statements, and so to free the uppermost or the intermediate metadata statements. So this is a way. Another one is obviously to add additional parameter to the metadata statement JSON, but it's another way, but I don't know, it can be more complex because then you need all the involved entities to understand that parameter that is somehow out of the standard. So,
yeah. David, all these models, if you just kind of suggest that there's one overarching single key. Traditionally, we have here devolved most of those decisions actually to the relying parties, so they have a choice of accepting zero or more federation types, say high assurance, medium assurance, different technologies, etc. Would this model not work equally well if there were no single overarching federation, but you just allow and give the tooling to the RPs to, say, pick four federations? So there's no longer a need for a global single master.
Oh yes, you don't need it. The problem with not having a root is just that you need to define an external authority in which you put your trust. So the way I was explaining the model, so figuring out that there is, say, something like a global OpenID Connect edu game that is a trust anchor for the intermediate research and scholarship entity category is just, I mean, to find a way to give authority to that intermediate club or community. But you have absolutely other ways to do that. I fully agree.
Yeah, but would it be not more logical to actually devolve that trust decision to the endpoints, to the relying parties, so that they make a decision that I want to do either, say, RNS and COCO, and only have, also include commercials, and just devolve that decision entirely? Because they, I think we have, at least our relying parties, typically trained to do that.
But there is a big but here, David. You can always get away without having one technical means of verifying trust, meaning removing one central key, but still you have to have something that will establish trust and knowledge between all these entities. Because in the end of the day, the relying parties, they will not know whom to trust, so they will have to have something, either technical or not technical, in order to be able to establish this trust, right? So, for example, within IGTF, this is IGTF itself. So IGTF does all these processes, and then creates a bundle and says to the relying parties, here you go, and here is your trust bundle.
Yeah. But if I look at, for example, EGI says we trust the stuff that comes out of IGTF and these two other things. They've typically done that. I think WLCG does the same. So that's more more relying parties than a single entity that's on top of everyone.
Well, there is no single technical entity, but still there is a body on top of everyone that everyone trusts. So you exchange this for that, right? Still, you have something.
Now, I think that the body that everyone trusts is actually scoped to the community. So it's easy to define that, but only for the people who already put trust into EGI.
Technically, I think also within LGTF, it is this body which everybody trusts and then signs the distributions that are being circulated to everyone. So it comes down to how these bodies govern and what technical means it implements to distribute the trust anchors, right?
Yeah, but I know that, for example, I'll take WLCG, that's maybe more clear. They've always included all of the IGTF, but their signed distribution also always included the Fermilab KCA, just because their community decided to also include trust in them. So, and it allowed, yeah?
Which is very similar to what the Federation are doing. They're taking the input from the EduGain feed, and then they also have their own metadata feed. I think, but I do understand, you put the point of governance and having a body that actually represents relying parties doing the governance, but how you express this technical trust, and then how the relying parties get this information and propagate it, is two different things, I think.
Yeah, say if the relying parties came up with an idea of such a, what would currently be an entity tag or then a federation doing only, say, life sciences research. In the model with a single route, that single route would then have to endorse the fact that such a federation existed. Whereas if it's an autonomous decision by the community, they could just add that life sciences ultimate trust to their set of trusted sources.
So if I can add something, maybe another question is also, I mean, who is allowing an RP to be part of the, say there is a research and scholarship federation, actually. Say that we want to model entity categories in the Open Edu Connect federation space like federation themselves. And not having them rooted at some in some hierarchy with some global federation out there. And so the question is, so how an RP is allowed to be part of that federation, and how an OP is allowed to be part of that federation, that is the Research and Scholarship Federation?
Yeah.
We need to, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think maybe you should have per this kind of text, or per say RNS or COCO, the federation is actually run and signed by the body that owns the document, that owns the policy statement. So RNS would be a tag in federation managed and owned by REFADS, and COCO would be managed by REFADS, but say Sanctify would be managed by IGTF, and Trust in Life Sciences would be managed by Brno, or so the one who owns the document actually owns a policy set, actually runs a federation.
Yes, and that can potentially have some can lead to some problem in I mean, how does it scale up if you have, say, thousands of entities that are requesting research and scholarship?
Wouldn't that naturally be devolved to the organizations? So you could put in a hierarchy below it.
Oh yeah, yes. So like the body that owns the document for research scholarship would trust an organization, and then the organization can sign the metadata statements of the entity. Yeah, this is the way.
So that would actually mean that instead of a single edugain, we'd actually have a set of probably four or five edugains, or probably more refetses, with a refets RNS and a refets COCO, and maybe an IGTF Sanctify and an IGTF Birch and an LSAAI, this is good for humans federation.
So we did have exactly this discussion 2 weeks ago, and I think the end result of this is that you will need then to invent something else that will broker trust for the poor users, that they will not know what to do. Because we will end up, I think, what we call federations, probably they will become something like metadata authorities, asserting something for entities. But then you will have a proliferation of these authorities that will say something about an entity, and then you will need something like proxies to be certainly there, that will aggregate all this information, make something useful for the clients that they actually do not know any of this stuff.
And that might actually be a role for what are currently the national federations, and it's a role that typically, say, EGI and WLCG have taken up on behalf of their back-end services.
Probably yes, probably yes, or even it might go even lower than that, but you need something given the scheme.
Yeah.
Can I ask something? Because I seem to have kind of a deja vu here. When the federations were created, that was a little bit the idea, right? That they didn't need anything, they would be peering with each other the way they liked. Then at some point, things got very messy, so everybody agreed that wouldn't scale. So why would it scale now? Because I think the model would allow technically to have everybody can spin up a federation would be much easier, let's say, with OpenADC. And then what you will be doing, you would allow these entities to exchange information in some form or shape, but at some point, when the number of entities becomes high, I cannot see how you can get away with having something that follows a little bit of a more hierarchical way.
Yeah, now the thing is, does the current model of Edugain actually scale? And I think the discussions around introducing Certify and RNS also strongly hint at the fact that Edugain in its current model, although it's technically centralized, also doesn't scale. I don't think we've ever solved the scalability problem.
No, but I think the reason why it does not scale, it's not a technical reason, because in fact it would be very easy to provide all the information to comply with all best practices that are there and things would work. The thing is that people just ignore things and they do their own things, and I cannot see this behavior changing with another technology, but maybe the technology could be easier, so you could introduce a different point that provides missing information like a proxy, and then you have all what you need.
Yeah. Now, I think the basic reason, that's why I'm trying to push a bit, is that by putting the responsibility in a different place, you get a different dynamics in the system. And by pushing the decision towards the relying party side, the one who's running the services and has an interest in joining a scheme, it maybe becomes easier to isolate, to innovate within communities.
What motivation does a relying party have to do a bunch of additional work, we will call it, to benefit a whole bunch of other relying parties?
It allows the... I think it's beneficial to get more people in. So you would be willing to support certain federations that have a whole bunch of interesting OPs in it.
Mm-hmm.
Then many RPs will share a common interest in doing that. I'm hoping that the research and the infrastructures pick up a role in pushing for some homogeneity within their community, to really build communities of interest. I'll never say that there will be an overlap in, say, banking applications and RNE federations, but at least within those communities you can benefit from sharing the same subset of federations. Maybe there is one. Everyone trusts the banks, but the banks will not trust us. Maybe you shouldn't trust the banks, but that's something else.
I think getting a sense of what our scalability needs are is really critical. Are we talking about IGTF level scalability where we have about 50 participants? Or are we talking about Edugain scalability with thousands of entities? And so obviously if you have an infrastructure that scales up to thousands, it is slower to move. to adopt new categories like RNS, as we see in Edugame. But that's because there's have to be multiple levels in the hierarchy and more formal processes to scale up so high. But if we think that the number of research collaborations that we see in IGTF today is about the number we would see adopting OIDC, then I think we could be a bit more agile and stay with the IGTF level of scalability.
In which case there already is a federating body that can do the work.
Can I ask something, Jim? When you say 50 participants, you mean 50 organizations, obviously, not final entities. And what is your estimate for entities on the other side, like actual number of RPs and OPs, more or less?
Right. The big difference is adding the RPs, because right now maybe each organization runs two CAs, and so we have under 100 CAs in the bundle, and maybe I probably will stay under 100 OPs, but we could have a lot of RPs, and that would be a new level of scalability for IGTF, and so that would be a big challenge for us, I think.
Yeah. Although I think again, there is hierarchies, so organizations can be below organizations as well. You can nest the organizations. So I would expect order 100 research collaborations globally, general RME research infrastructures, e-infrastructures, about 100. Each will have about 200 organizations below it. And those organizations each may spin up 2,000 RPs. So it gets you order a million RPs, but only 100 organizations to manage at the top level.
Oh, so would manage those 100 bodies and not those
people. Going back to the CMS experiment, you can have the CMS experiment to be an organization itself.
You would have probably WLCG as an organization that would get below its have to four experiments.
Exactly.
Now, I wouldn't expect CMS to show up independently. I would expect WLCG to show up, just as I would expect each of the S3s to show up. Or S3 clusters, actually.
Individuals from CMS might feel differently.
You'll have high energy physics and CMS. Good. I think we're slowly getting there with lots of components that we can use to scope the use cases. Can we move over to Nicolas? Who probably has a couple of EGI use cases.
Let me start sharing my screen. Apologies for the background noise. But
yeah.
Sorry, so we need to.
Yeah, you're breaking up a bit, but then you're sitting in an airport, so.
Yes, Wi-Fi is not optimal here, I think it will reconnect me every 45 minutes, so if I get disconnected, I will reconnect again. Okay, so initially the idea was to have a presentation about the EGI use cases, but I've sat together with Siraz from EGW to Access, so this presentation is about both EGI check-in service and the B2 access service. First, a short overview of what the check-in is and what B2 access, for those of you that don't know. So both are multi-protocol identity and access management solutions. They were developed in close collaboration with our project in order to implement the recommendation of the ARC blueprint architecture and the policy recommendations. Both proxies are registered in Edugame in order to allow the services that are connected to these proxies to make them available to over 2,000 universities and
I think that was the end of Nicholas. Round one.
He's not gone, he's just frozen. Been out in the snow too much.
Yeah, I think we'll have to wait for a bit. He made it back to Athens and now is calling in from the airport.
Which I wondered if all the others are present as well, but Jim's still moving. Yeah.
More orange.
Ryan is present. Oh, no, he's not.
Good. While we wait, at some point we'll have to probably run some operational services and build some stuff. And
yes, exactly.
I have a couple of people in IT, especially Misha Saleh, who is now connected, who can do something, but I don't want it to be an Amsterdam-only show. So who else would be willing to run some tests and think about that one?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're back.
We're back.
You can also share the video, the screen from here if you want. That's easier.
Which one, sorry?
If you want to save that with, I can present your slides from here if you want.
Ah, okay. So I will stop sharing and I will just tell you when to change slides. And let me stop sharing my video. Okay. So, slide number three, right? So this presentation focuses on the client registration processes that are followed. So there are basically three methods that are being supported. The first one is the approval-based client registration using email. The second one is similar to the first one, but using online web registration forms. And the third one is the automatic client registration, which is not non-approval based. So effectively, once the operator submits the request, it gets automatically accepted. But of course, this is only used for testing and development. Some more details about each of these methods. So the approval based client registration via email, we have the open ID client operators that send an email containing the registration request to the open ID client provider administrators. This request contains the required information for the client, so the direct URI and the purpose of the application. Optionally, is logo information. Then the open ID client provider administrators need to review the client details, and they can either register, accept, or reject the registration request. After that, the operator provider administrators will send an encrypted email containing the client credentials, so the client ID and secret, and the operator provider metadata information that clients need to register. So this is about static operator client registration by through the exchange of emails. Now the second approach is similar to this, but instead of the email, we have the online web form. So the operators will go to the open account provider website, and then they will use the registration form to submit the information for the client, so the direct URI, the return URI, the preferred client ID and secret, and all the other option information such as the description and the logo. And then the administrators of the open ID provider will either approve or reject the request. And based on their decision, the client operators will be informed via email. The third one, which as I said, is only used for testing, is the automatic registration, where the client operators visit again the website of the check-in or the B2Access website. They specify the client details, and then the request is automatically accepted, and they can test the integration. And after that, there's a new they need to contact again the open enterprise providers in order to migrate this setup to the production environment. So, to summarize the different approaches, we have some approaches that are only used for the testing, and these are based on the automatic registration, while the others are used in production, which require approval by the administrators. Of course, obviously the problem with automatic registration is that it's not a trusted process. But then again, with the approval-based approach, although it is considered trusted, of course it cannot scale because administrators need to review every open endpoint client registration request. They need to review and accept. And in the case of the email, it also require to have an exchange of emails with the operators of the Open ID Connect client.
And that was the end of Nicolas again. I think it's not 45 minutes, it's about 5 minutes. Yeah? Nicolas, are you back?
Yes, I'm back. Were you there for the last slide? I didn't, I'm not sure at what time my connection dropped.
Just before you started, you talked about the non-scalability of email, and then you dropped out.
Okay, so what EGI and EU does expect from this Open Connect Federation initiative is for a scalable and trusted registration mechanism. So we need the something that is considered both trusted and scalable. So this is the end of the presentation. Any questions?
Good. Thanks a lot. Do you have any idea of the number of clients we can expect, say, in 2 years' time? Year, 2 years from now? Is that still order?
Well, I mean, yes, I would expect that it would go in the order of hundreds. Now it's in the order of less than 100. Of course, it's in the order of tens, but I would expect that in 2 or 3 years' time, it will grow to the order of hundreds, yes.
Do we actually expect, with all the cloudy stuff, that we also be seeing microservices trying to auto-register? So you, every user actually implicitly gets a couple of OIDC clients?
Yes, I would say that this is expected. And we can already tell you from the development environment with my EGI hat, where we're doing where we started moving the Fed Cloud integration from certificates to OpenID Connect, that we can already see the increase in the number of required OpenID Connect clients. Sorry.
So trust can just be provide your credit card details here.
Yeah, I think there's
so
also
credit cards can be bought for like $1 a piece.
Yeah,
then.
That's cheap. For the, I think there's a role for the infrastructures there to devolve this process in some way. Especially the research infrastructure will need ways of enabling their users to register all their microservices in a way that actually puts the responsibility for those services in the proper spot. I don't think we should be, IGTF should not be in the business of trying to federate microservices. A million.
And this,
unless we get $5 for every registration. Maybe this, even then it's not.
Yeah, that's how you dial back the pump, associate a cost with it. So this was talking about methods to register, which gets things into the metadata. What about continuing to verify that things should still be in the metadata?
Yeah. Now, that's one of the things that's lacking here, and one of the things that Federation should bring.
Exactly.
I think. Current.
You can have some processes in the same. So go ahead.
No, I was just saying that you're absolutely right, and this is indeed an issue. It's not just the regulation; it's also the management of open digital data in the long run, not just the initial regulation.
Yeah. It's RC has the same issue. Ian?
No distractions.
We require for registering credential stores that talk to RCOR, we actually require a form that actually states compliance with the credential store guidelines, and it's managed in a secure data center, etc., etc., etc. We got two of them. GRNet went through that exercise, and KIT went through that exercise, and I think Marcus, he is still online, he knows, because he signed that form. After figuring out that there was no place to actually run a trusted credential store. But again, that's not maintained, so RCOth is in the same difficult position. We get people in, but it's like the Roach Hotel. Clients check in, but they don't check out.
That's Hotel California.
That's maybe a nicer analogy than the Roach Hotel.
Other browsers have this same issue,
yeah.
Right? I mean, they publish fairly detailed qualifications of how to get in there, and you've got to demonstrate how you do that, and then you've got to perform an audit on an annual basis to say that you're still doing that, and still that wasn't enough. Still, there's a whole bunch of technical compliance now that you also have to be demonstrating along the way to ensure that you should still be in there. And I think we've got to have some monitoring. Exactly, that was my point. So you can't just do this without the monitoring, without the deprovisioning capability. Otherwise, you don't end up with trust.
Trust but verify.
And how often do you verify? And what do you verify?
Yeah. Actually, most of the data about OIDC clients or entities is public, so you could conceivably run automated tests against the OIDC endpoints to see whether they're still there,
mm-hmm.
whether the key hasn't changed, or if the key is changing in unpredictable ways.
Mm-hmm.
Is that being discussed?
Another?
Yeah?
Another requirement that wasn't first out in the presentation was that the OpenID Connect clients, both in EGA and EGDAT, apart from this technical integration, so exchanging the direct URIs and the metadata, the other thing is the compliance with the infrastructure policies. So, for example, in EGI, a new client. Needs to assert compliance with EGA security policies, and currently this is not supported via the web registration form. And so the operator will need to sign to sign the compliance document, and send it to the operations. In EGDAT, this is a check in the web registration form. So basically, when we say that we need to check the VLAN connect lines after the registration, does that mean that we need to check that they are still compliant with the policies that they claim that they're compliant with? So we need to check in a year from now if the service in EGDAT is indeed compliant, in EGDAT that it complies with all the security policies.
There's a difference between a self-assertion about what I comply with and an audit by an independent party about what I comply with. Part of the reason why in IGTF we have peer review. Yes, we have self-audit, but then we have peer review of self-audit to trust but verify.
Yeah, I think that's something that you probably have to implement also within the organizations. So it has to be a hierarchical chain.
Mm-hmm.
So,
in this hierarchical model that we discussed previously, the RNS OIDC Federation would run some checks against its members to see if there's still if they can be part of the, if they can still be part of the RNS Federation.
Yeah, I think in EGI we do some of that testing with the security service challenges. So I'll see if they respond to a fake incident, and we did that once in a while. It's, the RGTF did it with communications challenges. I think that would be, but that would actually be a requirement then of that federation on its organization. So it should be spelled out in, say, RNS, that RNS means qualifying on entry and staying qualified. Good. If there are no more questions for Nicolas, let's do one more. And that's Marcus. Is Marcus still there?
Yeah.
To look at the use cases for the token translation service, and I think then we're at the end of the day. Marcus, are you still there?
Yeah.
Good. But we can't hear you. We can see your screen. That's about it. Marcus? Two OIDC clients, but no Marcus. Now we have no Marcus and no OIDC clients. Yeah. Hopeful sound.
Is Marcus? No voice yet.
Yeah, but we have. We now see the picture. We see your picture.
We require you to do sign language.
but now we have Marcus, but we lost the two OIDC clients and still don't have voice. We got the first two OIDC clients.
He's recording instead of...
No, but that's video itself, it's still the audio recording.
Okay, good. There you go.
Yeah. Two OIDC clients, Marcus, with no sound. Are you muted, by chance? Maybe we should use CC captioning. So somebody should interpret his lips and can type.
He's saying, I like ice cream.
Ice cream sandwich and jelly beans. Okay.
Okay.
You have the number? Numberless 040-8998-1350. That gets you to the Daisy call-in number.
So it's actually Pizza Hut.
And then the conference number is 109-338-677. Hash.
Hello?
Yeah! There you are!
Now I moved to the video so I can even see you. Fine, okay. So now for something completely different. I didn't really understand all the stuff about the OpenID Connect federations, but I think I'm the one to present use cases. David was mentioning mostly WATS, which is the first one, but I find personally much more interesting because we just developed it, the OpenID Connect client agent. So WATS is basically a simple service to enable any legacy service to leverage federated identities. So for example, I mean, it's just a website. You can log into this with your with OpenID Connect. And once there, we can execute for you scripts called plugins that, developers could upload and then provide some functionality. Right now, it's working for these X509 certificates that are issued by RCOCA under the IOTA label. For the life science ID that was earlier presented, we also have a simple SSH key upload or SSH key generation thing that could then in the background be used to distribute SSH keys, for example. It's written in Erlang and uses a self-written OpenID Connect client library. And we have four instances running that are mentionable. So we have for the life science ID, we have production and development, and for ourselves, we have also production and development instance. Apart from that, this is not so... I mean, that's it. It's a standard OpenID Connect client. It supports the standard Webflow. It has a REST interface, so people might want to connect to it from the command line. I don't think that there will be ever, so until the end of universe, be more than 30 installations. It's like the master portals from the Numerity. And in addition, maybe to add a bit more complexity, WATS is also a relying party to the RC Auth OP. So far, so good. The use case that I like more is the OpenID Connect agent. I like it more because it provides a bit of a different use case from the dynamic registration way. So the idea there is to give people the possibility to use command line and API access without any web authentication. The guiding pattern was the SSH agent. So we have an agent, we have a gen, we have an add. And they all work in a similar way. So the agent basically is a daemon that handles the tokens and the communication with the OP. It registers the client, the client ID with the OP, and we support a few flows to do that, and also the dynamic client registration to register our clients. The OSCGEN basically generates and stores the tokens, and OpenID Connect Add basically decrypts the refresh token, which is stored on disk, and passes it to the agent. That's some internals. But the interesting thing is, for the user, is this OpenID Connect token. He just runs it, and he gets his OpenID Connect token back. After and for this, we use the refresh token that is sent to the OP, and for that we get our client, our access token back, and that we return the access token to the user. The thing here is that it's the deployment scenario, which is different from the other OpenID Connect things that we have seen so far, because one user might want to have one or more clients, so client IDs, and wants to register them. So automatic registration is really important in this case. And I put this architecture into the slides just for reference, and I don't want to really go into details here, just in case you're interested, it's there. Most importantly was to mention what we currently support, so or what we have problems with. The dynamic registration is quite difficult. It's hardly supported by any OP. We have a few flows implemented, so the password flow is the simplest one. But some OPs didn't like to release a refresh token to some client that came was automatically registered and only authenticated with the password flow. Then we have the code flow, which basically requires a local web server to start up so we can do the redirect. And to avoid, this is what we currently implement because that's supported by most OPs. And we are currently also working on the device code flow so that we don't really need the local web server, and for scenarios where maybe this OIDC agent is run on a remote computer. Regarding currently current support for OPs, we have been funded by the Indigo project. So Indigo YAM was what we worked most closely with, and there we had the problem that the password flow doesn't include dynamic registration, so we had to do the manual registration with the administrator and wait for the email. This will work with the code flow pretty well soon. B2 access, we didn't find the dynamic registration yet. I just saw it in Nicolas' presentation that there's work on it. EGI check-in, we didn't get quite far there because we didn't find the offline access scope. And human brain is also still in discussion and still under development, because also they don't want us to dynamically register our clients. And that's where I think, I mean, we're really interested in simplifying the registration. And if need be, I probably have to understand how this IDC federation works to get this done. So that's it from me so far.
And the rest are hidden slides.
There are a few hidden slides. I just put for quick usage. I could give you a demo how it works, but I trust that you trust me that it works. Unless you want me to show it.
We all trust you.
Yeah. It is quite nice. I really have it on my computer, and I use it anytime I need a token. I just run open OIDC token, and I get my token. And yeah, some links, some additional information, but it's not really important, I think. Where have we stopped?
That's an interesting one, because this one will actually trigger as many new clients to register as a number of users times the number of devices they have, at least.
Yes.
Times the number of open windows.
Yeah, well, maybe in the open windows they would get just use the same refresh token and the same client to get another access token. So it's not as bad, but if you have a scenario like the grid where you want to submit one client with a different client ID than the one that you use on your notebook or so, you might have two clients. So it's not so bad, but the idea here is really to have one client ID per user, or maybe per power user. Yeah.
No, per user per device, probably.
Yeah.
If there's two or three devices, we are looking at potentially a couple of million clients if you're successful.
If this is supported, I mean, if it's not supported, if people say this is nonsense, it's fine. This was a part of a research project, and it's fine to not pursue this further. But still, I guess command line access and OpenID Connect somehow require something like this.
Seems like a topic that is of much interest to everyone.
Can I ask you, so, but wouldn't it be possible to use the same client credentials for all your devices so that you can indeed have one client per user? And then based on one refresh token, to get a different access token for each device. Wouldn't something like this work?
Well, you could also have just one client ID, which is like a web server, and then this one client ID distributes access tokens to all the users. But I think we went for this having one client ID per user because then you also have... No, I'm not sure. We wanted to be independent from an additional web server, so that's why we went only for an individual client. That was the plan there. Yeah. That's what I said. Yeah, if it doesn't make sense to go this way, we can of course change things. So.
No, but this is a use case to keep in mind if you want to look at especially the dynamic federation concept. Because this is, I think, the one use case that you will never be able to do manually. Is this a use case that would appeal to Exceed, Jim? Is this something you like?
Yes, it's very appealing. So I'm looking over the OIDC dynamic client registration spec, and where it has the initial access token, where you can have one token that gives access to the registration endpoint so that you can register additional clients. And so that gives us at least one level of indirection here, where we could approve clients that are allowed to register other clients. But unfortunately, the details are out of scope for that specification. So at least if we could agree on how we're all going to do that, it would be nice to have some interoperability there.
I agree that this is a very interesting use case also, and very appealing for ETI, and I guess also for EDOT. The problem is that, I mean, both Mitre ID Connect, which is used by EDI, and Unity Identity Management, they support dynamic registration. The problem is policies. So each operating client is considered a service. So in EDOT, you cannot register a service unless it's somehow assured that it is COCO compliant, and that it adheres to the EDI security policies. So it's not a lack of support for dynamic registration, is but how to do dynamic registration, assuming that the clients meet the policy requirements.
Yeah, but I agree with Jim that it's probably enough to have an access token for a user, and that authorizes the user to register his clients. So you bootstrap this thing once logging in via web, and then you copy the token, give it to the client, and then you go. So that probably solves the whole thing from that trust point of view of that client.
But even then, that one, the single client per user, that one would also need some way to assert that it complies with the policies of the research infrastructure.
But that maybe it's just ticking the box, the AOP box, which is what we ask our users to do now anyway.
Right.
Is it? I mean, that would be. I mean, if this is acceptable, that would indeed make things easier.
If it's if
the AUP.
If they're not capable of running a service, if you can somehow limit that, then they become just a user with an access token. If they're not technically capable of running a service. Does this bring up more ideas or use cases? Because otherwise I think we should keep it on the list as we discuss the Federation stuff. I also, now I'm looking at my watch, it's slightly over time. We're just about 40 minutes late, partially because of some video hiccups, also because we had a very good coffee here. Lots of sandwiches that we could not send to you, but we were really spoiled. Thanks.
I also need to get to a different call that started at 5. So yes. If you're right through with this, I would say goodbye.
Yeah, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Marcus.
See you, Urs will come tomorrow.
Yeah. Also, I think if there are no more questions, I would say we would close for today.
All right.
I think half of us are closed already. we are going to have a wonderful local dinner, about 10 minutes from here. Others I would leave to either a good dinner back at home, and sorry, Nicolas, that you've missed the social dinner here. Or to a good breakfast.
I know. Enjoy one or two.
Enjoy.
Good. Then, thanks, Jim. Go off and have breakfast, and maybe see you on one of the other days.
Okay. Good night.
At some point, I'll get back to you to put lots of effort into building stuff.
Yep, we have to get to work.
Yeah. And I think also to the others, Nicolas is back again for a while. I think hopefully it was also useful for the others. So Misha, thanks for staying on for this very, very long session. I hope it was useful. Or maybe we have left you entirely confused. And we'll reconvene tomorrow at 9:15. If I remember correctly. Yep.
They'll ask, is it 9 or 9:30?
9:15. Okay. Thanks very much. Enjoy your audios. A safe trip.
Thanks, gentlemen.
You hold your bags.
Bye-bye.